Randomized controlled trials have taught development economists a lot about the short-run effects of interventions. But what about the long run? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. The use of randomized controlled trials, or RCTs, in the last 20 years has revolutionized development economics and public health policy. But a generation after some of the most exciting trials, we know surprisingly little about the long-run effect of these interventions. A new CEPR discussion paper summarizes what we've learned about long-run impacts. It also suggests which RCTs might be ready for another look and how we might go about it. And one of the authors is Dr. RCTs himself and also a CEPR fellow, Ted Miguel of UC Berkeley. And if you've studied development economics, chances are you'll know about some of the trials he's been involved with. Ted, welcome to Vox Talks.
Thanks, Tim.
For the non-economists who are listening, can you sketch out what the distinctive features of an RCT are and why they are so important?
RCTs are a tool that we use in economics and social science more broadly that are based really on medical trials, which I think most people are familiar with. Mm. In a medical trial, there's a treatment group that gets a particular intervention. So in health, it started with a particular drug or medicine. In economics, it may be an economic assistance program, a cash transfer program, something like that. And then there's a control group that doesn't receive that sort of intervention or assistance. What is distinctive about RCTs is the selection into the treatment group and the control group is randomized, as per the name, randomized controlled trial. So there's really no systematic difference between the treatment and control groups when the study starts. Any differences that we observe between them later on can be attributed to the intervention itself.
Given the resources and the time that are spent on development interventions, it may surprise people how little we know about their long-run impact and cost effectiveness. Why are these long-run evaluations so difficult to do?
That motivation is exactly why we wrote the paper that you referred to before. There's been an explosion of RCTs in development economics, and there's a lot of potential to learn from them. But as you said, we haven't learned that much. I think there's a few important reasons why it's been hard to learn about long-run impacts. One is a lot of these RCTs are actually relatively recent. They were only carried out, say, 5 or 10 years ago. So we're only now beginning to be able to understand their long-run impacts. There was an early wave of these studies really starting around the year 2000, and I was lucky enough to be involved in some of those. And it's really those earlier ones that are now starting to be evaluated to try to understand long-run impacts. The goal of this study is really to assess what we've learned and what we can learn. You know, some of it is just a timing issue, but it's also very challenging to do long-run studies. Most of the RCTs in development rely on original data collection carried out by the scholars or carried out by a nonprofit or NGO that they're working with. So it's quite costly to go and find these individuals, the participants in the study, 10 or 15 or 20 years later. You've got to track them down. You've got to survey them. And we face a problem called attrition. We lose part of the sample over time just because they're hard to find. So these are some of the challenges that we face in this work.
And given it's so challenging, what's the big win here? What's the biggest benefit if we can do these long-run evaluations?
When we work in development economics, we're very concerned as a central intellectual question on the effect of what we're doing on long-run living standards. We're interested in alleviating poverty. We're interested in improving children's education, their life prospects. And you can really only assess those things over time. A short-run effect is useful to know about. It's great to know if an intervention helps someone over a year or two. But if you can transform their life or their family's life over 10 or 20 years or permanently, the cost-effectiveness of that intervention looks entirely different. And an intervention that could really transform people's life trajectories over decades is something that policymakers would be very excited to know about. So that's why we've really emphasized this question in this paper. That's why we think this is so important for economics as a whole.
And is there that lingering doubt that some of these successful results in the short term, they might not be long-run effects?
Exactly right. And in fact, as we did this survey of the studies that have been evaluated over, say, at least a 10-year time horizon, which is what we're calling roughly long run, we found a number of interventions that looked very exciting and promising over that, say, 2-year time horizon that when you go out to 8 or 10 years, really don't appear to have persistent effects. So, for example, there's been a lot of interest in cash transfer programs in development. People may have heard of some very large government programs that are increasingly designed as unconditional cash transfers, a one-time cash transfer. So if you give a poor family in Uganda or in the Philippines $400 or $500, over the short run, their life really does improve. So these are successful programs in affecting people's quality of life over a couple of years. They can buy more food and clothes, for instance, over the short run. But when studies have gone back to assess the effects of those one-time unconditional cash transfers 6, 8, 10 years later, they tend to find pretty disappointing effects. They tend to find limited impacts. Now, more work needs to be done, and that's another point of our paper, that we're really just starting to do these evaluations. But based on a few of the studies that have done long-run effects, it appears that some of these benefits basically just peter out over time. And that's very important for policymakers to know when they're allocating resources.
When you read papers about RCTs, one of the things that's very obvious to you is it's a lot of hard work. So who's taking on this re-evaluation, these long-run evaluations so far?
Scholars themselves have typically followed up their own studies, sometimes with the cooperation of governments in the countries where they've worked. There's also been some foundations that have supported some of this work. So there's really a number of different institutions, governmental, nonprofit, academic, who have gotten together and started to decide this is a very important thing to do, and they're putting resources behind it. In the case of my own work, we've been doing follow-up surveys now of some early RCTs that were carried out in Kenya in the late 1990s, in particular, some school health interventions. The best known is a deworming study that took place in primary schools in Kenya starting about 20 years ago. We've been following up that group of participants now for 20 years. The advantage that we have in the work that we've done is we really never stopped tracking them down. So from the very beginning, we kept track of our participants. We've surveyed them frequently every few years since then. And we've been very lucky to have support from the U.S. government, the National Institutes of Health. We've had support from the World Bank and other governmental and non-governmental groups. So I think there is a recognition that this is a critical issue for policy, but it's very hard work and it requires a lot of resources to find people 10 or 20 years later.
One of the things that also comes through in the paper is that when we look at these long-run effects, the effects are often different for different people. And the most obvious one is for boys against girls or men against women. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Exactly. That's really something that's come through very strongly in the research. In a lot of low-income countries where we focus our work, men and women or boys and girls just have very different educational opportunities, very different labor market opportunities. So it isn't maybe surprising that the effects of an intervention could differ by gender. One of the things that's come through in a number of the interventions in health and education, some of the things that I've studied and other scholars, including my co-author Michael Kramer, with the work we've done together in Kenya, the work that he's done with co-authors in Ghana, is big gender differences. So in the Kenyan case that we've studied, this long-run deworming follow-up, we find interesting patterns. Over the long run, we see quite large increases in educational attainment, so access to secondary school among girls whose health improved when they were children. So they benefited a lot in that dimension. We find weaker effects on education for the young men, but we find much stronger effects for them in the labor market. And again, part of that could have to do with the opportunities that men have relative to women in the labor market. But if you go out 15 years after the deworming intervention, the men tend to be earning a lot more money. They tend to have better jobs. They're more likely to have jobs in factories and the manufacturing sector, where wages are very high in Kenya. And fewer women get those kinds of jobs. But the women are benefiting in other ways, including more schooling. And this issue highlights the importance of doing long-run follow-ups. One of the things that we find with the women who are now in their late 20s or early 30s is a pretty large share of them are out of the labor force, probably temporarily, as they're in peak childbearing years and they have a lot more family responsibilities that they have to take on in the Kenyan context. It could be, though, that those educational gains that the girls experienced in Kenya will eventually reflect themselves in higher earnings and living standards a little bit down the road when they can re-enter the labor force. So we might say, well, over 10 or 15 years, there isn't much of a labor participation gain or earnings gain for women. But as we track them over time, we're really going to be able to understand those effects. So it's very important to do these long-run follow-ups, or you could miss a lot of benefits.
One of the great services you provide with this paper is you've gone through all the major RCTs that you can find, and you've sorted out the ones that may be good candidates for these follow-ups. What makes an RCT a good candidate for a long-run evaluation study?
Yeah, this was a lot of work, the process of going through this work. And to be honest, my co-authors, Adrian Bougain and Yue Huang, did an incredible amount of work sifting through hundreds of RCTs that have come out in the last couple decades. We had several criteria to figure out which of these would be promising for follow-ups. Some of the criteria are pretty basic. So some studies are very small in terms of sample size. They don't have that many participants. And so what you can learn statistically, or the kind of information content of that study, is relatively limited. So the statistical terminology, we really needed enough statistical power to say something definitive. So those studies are definitely more attractive. There's also the issue I discussed before, survey attrition. For some of the studies, they already tried to do some sort of medium run follow-up, maybe 3 or 4 years out. And in some of those studies, they found it very challenging to find participants even 3 or 4 years after the intervention. And there were maybe very good reasons why it was hard to find people, why they thought it would be very costly or challenging to track respondents, possibly due to migration or other factors. Those studies would not necessarily be great candidates for long-run follow-ups. It may just be too challenging to find participants. So those are a couple of the main factors. One of the things that we think is very important to keep in mind when thinking about which studies to follow up is to get a really representative sense of the long-run effect of an intervention. It would be best intellectually and conceptually to follow up studies, whether they had large short-run effects or small short-run effects. We wouldn't just want to study in the long run interventions that had really huge short-run effects, because we'd get a kind of biased picture of the true average long-run effect of a certain intervention. So as long as follow-ups are feasible, we think it's very important to try to follow up a wide range of studies that had maybe a variety of short-run impacts.
But this is problematic in itself, isn't it? Because it's really only the RCTs with large short-run effects that get published or get publicized. And some of those that didn't show a short-run effect, they might be forgotten or have not had very much attention. But really, we need to look at those as well.
Exactly. We feel that's a very important point conceptually. It's very important for us to have a really robust sense of what an intervention does, not just in the best case scenario. And I think if you only looked at the most famous study or the study that had the largest effects after 2 years, you could have a very unrepresentative look at the true effect of the intervention. So that's something that's very important. And we are happy that funding agencies and governments and policymakers seem to be quite interested in understanding these long-run effects. The best way forward, in our view, would be a large-scale coordinated initiative, say in the area of cash transfers or child health, which we focused on in this review mainly, looking across maybe a dozen RCTs with a range of short-run effects in a range of different geographical settings and putting together a very comprehensive picture of likely long-run impacts.
Are there any alternatives for collecting this long-run data other than just trying to track down the people that were involved in the study in the first place? Do we have any more access to data that might be useful?
Yeah, there are new opportunities, and it's a very exciting time in development economics right now because the data environment has changed very quickly. We have a lot of experience in development economics in running and collecting household survey data, very detailed questions that we ask respondents typically face-to-face. But there are new data sources. There are big data sources. So, for instance, there's new approaches to measuring poverty based on remote sensing data, satellite data. Let's say there were certain communities that received an intervention. It could be a cash transfer or some other intervention. Other communities didn't. Scholars have shown that you can measure the crop yields on their farm plots pretty well from satellite data. So it could save you a lot of money and time if you can extract data from satellite imagery and run the algorithms that have been developed to assess crop yields. So for an agricultural program or an agricultural intervention, That may be a very cost-effective way of measuring crop yields. There's also been improvements, thankfully, in government administrative data collection in many low-income countries in recent years, where it's now possible to follow up respondents in government databases the way you would in a wealthy country like the UK or the US or other wealthy countries. So there are some changes that are positive in that direction. There are also some limitations to those new data sources. So with the satellite data, you can measure crop yields very well, and you can measure some other things, but you can't get the kind of detailed richness that survey data provide. So in some of our surveys that we collect in the field with households, we ask them not just about what they earned, but we ask them why they did what they did. And we try to understand their goals, their aspirations. Mm. We measure their mental health, their happiness. Those are things that obviously satellite data can't deliver. So I think we're looking at a future where we're going to be combining the traditional household survey data with new data sources, but they each have their upsides and their downsides. Of course, the upsides of the satellite data is it can be very cheap, but it's only very good at measuring certain things.
One of the things that anyone who's been involved in planning one of these trials will know is how carefully you have to go through planning out what the evaluation's going to be, how you're going to measure the effects. Do you think that in future there should always be the capacity to come back, do these long-term evaluations? That should be something that is naturally a part of any one of these trials.
That's something that I would really like researchers starting RCTs to incorporate into their workflow from the start. One of the goals that we have in writing this paper is to highlight the promise of long-run follow-ups, especially now that there are new data sources, that we have gotten better at dealing with some of the data challenges. If you can build in from the start your procedure for tracking sample, for putting in place questions in early baseline survey that'll help you find people, that'll provide data that could be useful for a long-run follow-up, it becomes much easier to do it later on. And really, that's what our experience in Kenya for the long-run follow-up of the deworming intervention has showed us. As I mentioned earlier, we never stopped tracking this sample. And I think that's the reason why we've been able to really continually find them at very high rates. We really have established rapport with many participants in the study over these many years. Now we're at the 20-year follow-up point. But if we hadn't built in that data collection from the start and we had to go back now at 20 years, I think it would be almost impossible to find these participants.
You've been very active, Ted, in publicizing, in the social sciences in general, the fact that some of our policy interventions over the years have been built on surprisingly flimsy evidence. So is this paper and this sort of activity part of your plan for hardening up the evidence base in social sciences?
I've been really concerned about the evidence base, and I've worked to promote research transparency and reproducibility in the social sciences. I've been working on this with colleagues here at Berkeley through an initiative called the Berkeley Initiative for Transparency in the Social Sciences. It's something that I feel strongly about. And one of the goals of that whole endeavor and that initiative is to do a better job of bringing together bodies of evidence in rigorous ways, not just focusing on one or two high-profile studies, but really getting a good sense of what a body of evidence can tell us through meta-analysis, through other methods. And this push for more long-run follow-ups in a coordinated fashion, this push to try to understand the body of evidence, say from 10, a dozen, maybe 20 studies that could be followed up in the long run, is definitely part of that endeavor. I think we have a long way to go. There's a lot of work that needs to be done to put together the body of long-run evidence. But what we see now is the possibility of doing so. And I think until a few years ago, there wasn't the sort of base of RCTs that was needed to generate that evidence. We didn't have the expertise in survey tracking and longitudinal data collection that we have now. I think now is really the time for this kind of work. And that's why we wrote this piece. We see an incredible intellectual opportunity and one that can inform policy in low-income countries in the years to come.
Empirical research seems to be driving innovation in what economics is. Is this something that you perceive as well?
Yeah, definitely. The field has changed. I started my PhD studies in 1996. And at that time, I think the majority of articles that were being published in journals were more theoretical. And the goal that many of us had maybe when we started grad school was to be part of that community of more theoretical researchers. But with the availability of new data and a much more, as you said, empirical focus on what really works in the world, the field has changed. And development economics has certainly been in the forefront of that change. It's been very exciting to be part of this transformation of the field. Of course, we still benefit a ton from economic theory. It structures how we think about the world. But it turned out that a lot of economic theories, when rigorously tested in the world, were wrong. And we've continued to build economic science on data now, not just on theory. We really combine theory and data together. And the RCT revolution in development economics, which has spread to other parts of economics and spread even beyond economics into political science and other fields, has been a very big part of changing the field. And I think at the end of the day, economics is much more scientific than it was 20-something years ago. And I think that's a good thing.
Fascinating. Ted Miguel, thank you.
Thanks so much, Tim.
This paper, as you've heard, is an interesting glimpse into the future of economics. It's an insight into the essential features of RCTs. And it's also a great summary of much of the important empirical work in development and public health that's been done over recent years. So that's three reasons at least to read it. The title of the paper is Using RCTs to Estimate Long-Run Impacts in Development Economics. And the authors are Adrienne Bougain, Wei Huang, Michael Kramer, and Edward Miguel, or Dr. RCTs, as I called him before. And it's DP13443. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We feature early-stage research in economics, and there's a new episode every Friday. So subscribe on your podcast platform. Tell your friends, and don't forget the archive at www.voxeu.org/vox-talks.